This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at REACH 2017, held on March 23 and 24, 2017, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's good to be together like this. I'd just like to start by qualifying everything I'm saying today, that what we're talking about here, yes, is pretty foundational and important, and I hope that you're here because you already have it figured out. For me, it was a journey of discovery, and I still don't have it all figured out. But most of what I have to talk about here today is born out of some pretty challenging, difficult times in my own life, in our organization's life, and my mistakes and other people's mistakes all coming together to kind of create a perfect storm of events that cause me to get pretty passionate about the theme of trust. I was talking to a pastor, a First Nations pastor in Northern Ontario. He's a leader of a small church in a remote community. 800 people live in this community, and he is a very solid, stable pastor. Like, literally, he is the George Brunk of First Nations churches. Does that make sense? And I said, what's your relationship like with the people in your community? And he said, well, nobody trusts me. Nobody talks to me. Everybody is afraid of me because they know that if they talk to me, that they're going to be talking about, you know, my brother-in-law and my sister. And it just made me think a lot about our Mennonite communities and also our organizations. Everybody knows everybody. And so if I open up and be vulnerable and share, then, you know what? Game's over, isn't it? Feels like that. That's what trust is, a big part of life. So today we're going to be talking about trust, we're going to be talking about leadership, we're going to be talking about teams, and in that order. And I have a lot of material here. I hope you have your handouts in front of you. My delivery process here is to give you a bunch, way more than you can handle today, and then you can chew on it for the next couple weeks while maybe the Lord will direct things to you as you review things. So, like I said, I got to keep moving fast. So, why do we need trust? Trust is the foundation of all relationships. There cannot be a relationship if there is no trust. Society today is in a famine of trust. When we look at all the broken homes and the broken churches and the broken businesses, society is in a famine of trust. That's really what people are calling out for and crying out for. So people are looking for something that where you feel safe, and when you have no trust, you don't feel safe, and so that's a big part of what's going on in society today. Trusting relationships are at the core of our witness that we are Christ's disciples, and since I'm talking to missionaries, that's the one we're going to capitalize on. Jesus said that hereby will the world know that you're my disciples if you love one another. So the bottom line, folks, is if in our ministries and our churches, if we don't have trusting, loving relationships, our witness is out the door. Now we're just doing it for pretend instead of for real. But if we have trusting and loving relationships, harmonious relationships where we support each other and back each other up, then it's almost, we're an unstoppable force to the enemy of the gospel if we have that relationship with each other. So I hope you get the picture that trust is really not an option. It's the perfect, it's what's completely essential to ministry. Jesus' prayer was that, he said in John 17, he says, my prayer is not for them alone. So he's not talking just to the disciples. He's also talking, I pray for those who will believe in me through their message. So who will believe in Christ through the message of the apostles? That's you and I today, 2,000 years later. So Jesus, way back there, was praying for you and I today, saying that all of them may be one, Father, as you and I are one. So Jesus is praying that today we are one, just the way that the Father and the Son and the Spirit are one. Powerful, folks. That's the bar. That's the standard that Jesus wants us to meet. That's how he wants us to live. Can you believe it? I so often have not been there. So often I've been so far from that, that it's just mind-boggling. So love and oneness require trust. If there's no trust, there is no love, and there's no oneness. So our model is the Trinity. Jesus and the Father and the Spirit are in perfect relationship with each other. You cannot imagine the Holy Spirit coming to the Father and saying, yeah, did you see what Jesus did over there? Like, I'm not sure that he was, like, was he honest? Like, would the Holy Spirit do anything like that? What if Jesus, or the Father and the Son would start talking to each other and say, you know what, the Holy Spirit, he's kind of getting carried away. Like, he's really building this church, and this church is getting big, and it's got a lot of people in it. Like, what if they rebel against us? The Father and the Son won't do that kind of thing. The Father and the Son and the Spirit had the same perfect, 100% all the time agenda. They had the same plan. They had the same goals, and they have perfect trust with each other. And that's what Jesus is praying for us. So you understand a bit about the trust. Now let's look a bit at some leadership behaviors that undermine trust. Leaders that work completely independently of everybody don't need to worry about this. You already have no trust, okay? But leaders that are working in team should pay attention to some of these things. So what are some leadership behaviors that undermine trust? Talk about secret alliances, where two guys go off and kind of create an agenda to create a political swing, maybe do an end run over around the rest of the team. You know, you've probably seen it happen. I have. I've done it. Talk about dishonest disclosures and partial truths. When we say a story, we say it, you know, so that it makes us look good and makes somebody else look bad, and those kinds of things just dissolve trust. What about when we take advantage of others through deception? When we create deceitful things that, like I said, put us on a pedestal and put somebody off a pedestal. We can talk about squelched communication and censorship. We can talk about saying, you know, when I change your story, if one of you has a message and I come around and I misrepresent you, squelching communication or censorship. Another one that really gets at some parts of people, like some team members will be really sensitive to this whole thing of public put-downs. If you're in a team meeting and the leader just shreds another member of the team verbally, like, that team member will probably never talk again. Like, he'll be destroyed, and he's not going to want to be a part of that team. And even if he sits in that team, his heart's not going to be there. His heart's going to be closed and guarded. He's going to protect himself. This other one is aggressive domination of others. Like, I don't know if you've ever been around somebody that no matter where they go, they're always 100% in charge. That's just how some of us are wired to naturally do that. And it can soon start to work on trust. We as leaders can hurt people. We have incredible power to hurt and to heal. So what is trust? Trust is the firm belief in the reliability, the truth, the ability, the strength of someone or something. And trust, if you forget everything else that I'm saying, trust comes by living with our eyes open and experiencing reality. Trust comes from knowing what's really going on and not having a lot of shadows in our lives or where things are hidden. If we don't know, then we really have a hard time building trust. So the foundations of trust are that there's truth. Like, as long as people are lying, trust will never be built. And how do we get truth? We get truth through transparency and familiarity. Like, there's a lot of people that haven't lied to me, but I don't know them, right? Like, many of you, most of you, I don't know. And I have no reason to not trust you, but guess what? We haven't really been through it together, and we haven't really built a strong foundation of trust. Now, back in the back corner sits Merle Burkholder. He's on our board. Him and I have walked a journey. Guess what? I trust Merle. I know Merle. Merle knows me. I think he trusts me. Okay, so we have that kind of relationship. You know, it's been developed over time. There's some familiarity, and we have talked very openly about a lot of things. So there's a lot of transparency, a lot of familiarity. A third foundation of trust is integrity and reliability. You know, am I the same person today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day? Do people that know Norm, do they kind of know him, or am I different to different people and whatever? And the last one is competence. Without competence, eventually trust falls short. Like, I fly airplanes, and I bet you that if you get in the airplane with me, you want me to know how to fly the airplane. Because if I don't know how to fly the airplane, you expect that somebody else had better get in and do it, and you're gonna believe that I know how to fly the airplane, but, you know, if I would actually crack up somewhere, then you'd say, well, maybe he didn't have what it took. Competence, a big part of trust. All right. We have this other thing called being naive. I went through a specific period in life where I was asked to do things where I knew that I didn't know what was going on, and I knew I didn't have what it takes, but I was very naive. My lack of experience, my lack of wisdom, my lack of judgment made me say, sure, yes. Any of you been there? If you're less than 25 years old, you're at high risk for being naive. And if you're less than 50 years old, you probably remember some time when you were naive. Naive is what it means to live with our eyes closed. Like, it's being uninformed and having the greatest of intentions, but not enough knowledge about the facts to actually make a well-informed decision. So those of us that are in leadership, that are recruiting other people, for us to build trust, we have to give them the enough facts that they can make a well-informed decision, not just put the bait out that they chomp on and then we got a hook somewhere. You know, that kind of destroys trust. So we have to make well-informed decisions. Being naive comes from living with our eyes closed, but the danger about being naive is it creates a shallow illusion of trust. Like the fish totally trusts the minnow, right? When he takes a bite, but he doesn't know there's a hook in the minnow. And because the fisherman has hidden the hook, doesn't mean there is no hook. And so when we're in leadership, it's important that we create the framework where people can make well-informed decisions. They know what we're after, they know what's going on, so that when somebody else says, yes, I'll do that, that they are fairly confident that maybe they're still signing up for some kind of wild ride of life, but they at least they know that we have their best interest in mind and we're trying to protect them in the process. So again, problem with being with naive is it creates an illusion of trust, but it is not trust, it's the opposite. All right, then there's this thing of mistrust. Mistrust is the feeling that someone or something can't be relied on. Like, there's some people and places where I actually don't trust. Like, why? Because I've been hurt by those things. And I say, I will not put myself back in that situation. I might forgive, I might recover, but you know what? I just don't need to do it again. So why would I? Because I don't actually trust. And so mistrust comes from being hurt or mistreated, and we can heal from that, but we also learn from it, and there's things we don't necessarily do again. So you guys tracking with me, understand what we're talking about as far as what trust is, what lack of trust is, some of the leadership things we can do that destroy trust. All right, so we're talking about trust, we're talking about leadership. I'd like to talk just briefly about some of the effects of, these are like social pressures that have effects on the amount of trust that people have in society in general. If you look at North American culture the last 100 years, there's some specific ages. They talk about the Industrial Age and they talk about the effects of World War II, I think, are very profound and probably not well recognized. They're so vast that we all think it's normal, but there's some huge effects that World War II has on society. And then now there's the information age, the age of the internet. So in general, these are very broad generalizations and it's not, yeah. I think in the Industrial Age, and I think a lot of our good solid Mennonite and Amish background and work ethic has a bit of the same flavor to it, where the Industrial Age, you're trusted for what you do. Like people that can work 14 hours a day and create the best crop of corn or have the best herd of cows or get the most built in their mechanic shop or their machine shop, those are the people, right? They're really doing it. We can trust those guys because they have a superior output, all right? The Industrial Age really produced that mentality in society. Like we trust Henry Ford because he's like the inventor of mass production. Like that's a great guy. Well, wartime is very different. You don't necessarily get trusted for doing a lot of stuff. You get trusted for putting your life on the line. Like if you're 18 years old and you can jump out of airplanes when people are shooting at you, then why, we trust guys like that, because they've got nothing to lose. They're just some They're heroes. You know, we trust those guys. Well, okay. Then along comes the information age, and there's this whole crowd of people that says, you're 18 years old, and you jump out of an airplane with people shooting at you. You must be really stupid. Well, that's a whole flip in attitude. And the generations that we're working in today, we've got a bit of all three of those. And so we got, right now, we've got people that are in their 70s and 80s that are saying, well, like, we'll trust you if you prove yourself that you can do stuff. And we've got people that are saying, well, we'll trust you if you can be a missionary and live on rice and beans for 40 years and never see another soul. Like, you make a sacrifice, we'll trust you. Then you've proven that you are somebody. And at the same time, we've got young people that are coming into missions and saying, well, we'll trust you if you can prove us that you're smart. Different dynamics at play in our Mennonite circles today. So think about where you are, and before you evaluate the trustworthiness of another individual, think about who you are and where you are and where they are in that spectrum. One of the major tragedies in society today is that we probably are surrounded by more abused people than, I don't know, than we'd recognize maybe. And I'm talking about things like physical and sexual abuse, things like psychological, emotional, spiritual abuse. I know those are not popular topics, but they're real life tragedies that are walking in our midst, and some of us are those kinds of people. The effects of abuse on trust is, number one, it's a feeling gets stirred inside of us that we can't trust anybody because they're going to take advantage of me if I trust them. And again, there's healing available for that. That feeling often leads to a decision that I will not trust nobody. Now we have an individual that's walking around with their arms out here and they're saying, nobody gets closer than this to me because I can't trust anybody, because people hurt me, people take advantage of me. And yes, that's partly true. That's how it is. That then often turns into an expectation of, well, you need, maybe, just maybe I'll trust you if you perform to this standard, then I'm going to trust you. And at some point, people don't meet those expectations, and then often that crowd of people gives up and says, well, you have to rescue me, you have to fix me up. And we have all kinds of broken relationships and demands that we place on each other because way back there somewhere, we decided that we can't trust anybody. And guess what? In leadership teams, I would venture to guess, if we look at pure statistics, that 3 out of 5 men in a leadership team have experienced sexual abuse. And maybe there's more than that. I don't know. I'm not a counselor. Somebody here like Loyal would probably have better information than I do on that. The tragedy, the walking tragedy among us, is that we have those dynamics in our midst. And it destroys leadership teams if we're not healing, if we're not on a healing journey from that. So let's talk a bit about recovery from abuse. The truth is that Jesus needs to rescue me. If I need to be rescued, it's not by you. I need to be rescued by Jesus Christ. And I need to respond to life as it's been handed me. The truth is that not all of us have been handed a good deck of cards, so to speak, but we all are responsible to play the hand we've been given. That's just how life works. I will take responsibility. That's an action. That means I do stuff to be responsible, to act responsibly. And then I will trust again. That's a very hard decision for some people, and relationships can be restored. So what does it take to restore trust? First of all, discover truth. So in order to expose truth, people have to talk honestly, and they have to use words. Sometimes I talk very honestly, but it all stays in my own head, and it never comes out of my mouth. And so we have to talk honestly with words. We often need help to get channels of dialogue open for all parties to hear. Like if there's blockages and people are so offended and violated by each other, then somebody else needs to come in and say, you know what, like, brothers, let's talk about this issue, just one issue. And often that can kind of build hope in the lives of people involved to get on a healing journey with each other. You know, the truth often hurts, and that's okay. So one big part of restoring trust is to allow people time to emotionally process the truth. Like, if somebody comes and dumps a truckload of truth on top of you about what kind of person you are and all your failures you've made and how you've hurt them and all that, and then expects you to just right away just like snap out of it and not feel that, that's not really a responsible way of talking honestly with words. Like, when we talk honestly with words, it needs to be gracious and seasoned with salt. Grace and truth need to come together and kiss each other. And so when we start opening these channels for dialogue, then we also have to give people time. And some people take lots of time. Some people take a little bit of time, but we all need it. We would want it for ourselves, right? And followers of Christ want to treat other people the way they'd want to be treated, so we want to give each other time. Fears need to be exposed. Often there's a lot of hidden fears, and we all have hidden fears, but what are they? They're hidden, right? Mm-hmm. So what are they? They got to be exposed. And safety needs to be formed for the vulnerable. In any team, there's people that are more vulnerable. You have young people that are maybe naive. They're vulnerable. We also have aged people whose ability to understand things is somehow starting to kind of atrophy. They kind of know what they know, but it's hard for them to absorb new ideas, new thoughts. And so safety needs to be formed for the vulnerable, and often, again, that takes some outside help in this process. All right, at some point, trust becomes a decision, and trust involves setting aside fears and taking relational risks. Very specifically, leaders do what? It's so obvious you shouldn't have to say it, but I'm going to ask you to say it. What do leaders do?
Lead.
Yeah, which means going first, right? All right, so for us to build trust in leaders as leaders, we need to be willing to take the first step. That means be the first person to say, you know what, I messed up here. Or the first person to say, you know what, hey, I'm willing to give this relationship another try. And if we can't do that, we can't lead. That's just how it is. If we're always waiting for somebody else to go first and fix the relationship for us, we will be trapped for the rest of our lives. And that's not a great option. So leaders lead. So we make that decision, we take relational risks. Trust involves dealing with past hurts in as much detail as those feelings hinder the relationship. Like, not everything everybody has ever done that has hurt you needs to necessarily be processed. But if it hinders your relationship, maybe it's a good deal to address it. Trust also involves setting boundaries for ourselves as to how much we will trust another person. Sometimes when there's been a significant amount of hurt, we say, you know what, I'm going to take one step and I'll now trust this person with this one thing. Just to give you a very practical example, if somebody has hurt me very deeply, I might, in a process of restoration, say, you know what, I will now trust him with driving my car. Okay? If he wrecked the last car, it's going to be a big step to say, I'll trust him with driving my car. But I won't trust him with driving my car with my child in it. See, we can take some practical steps on how we rebuild trust. Trust is not a blank check. I have often felt very guilty for not trusting people, okay? I've often felt like, well, if this relationship would be all fixed, then I would just let him have my heart, so to speak. Well, that's not really realistic. Trust isn't a blank check. It's a check that's filled in with an amount that I've decided. So I decide how much I will trust and how much I will give the other person that they could potentially destroy for me. So how much of my heart, how much of my life, how much of my relationships. Like, I don't trust anybody with my wife. Like, she's mine. And no, you don't get her.
Amen.
Like, if you think you want my wife, guess what? We're going to have to, like, I don't know what, but it's not going to be great. So trust is, yeah. What are you going to give to someone else? Really what it boils down to. To give ourselves permission to trust as much as is needed or warranted. So, all right, we've talked about trust. We've talked about some leadership things. Now let's talk about team things. Because when we talk about leadership in team, that means we're all leaders, which means we're all guys that like to go first, and we all have good ideas, or we wouldn't be there. All right? It's just kind of natural. problem with getting all these guys that are to have good ideas together in one room, sometimes they all want to go first at the same time, and they don't all fit through the door necessarily at the same time. And so there's some stages of team development, and I think these stages are very applicable to leadership teams. So this is adapted from Bruce Tuckman's model of team development. You can find it on the internet. It's pretty powerful. Ultimately, this team development model answers the question of developing trust. Since it is a model, each step builds on the previous one, and each step prepares us for the final stage of performing. And if you skip any step, then performance will be negatively impacted. With every new challenge, I would like for you to highlight this fact. Whenever a team has been formed and is doing well, sometimes you have a transition where, you know, the bookkeeper changes, and then it's the secretary changes, and this team gets really disrupted whenever that happens. And so when that happens, you have in some way, you have to go back to the start and reform and restorm and renorm and then perform. So with every new challenge, the process repeats. I really like this this cartoon. It says, what does MFU2 mean on your timeline? Well, that's management foul-up number two. It usually happens around the third week. We don't anticipate management mistakes. Well, that's MFU number one. So one of the big things for leadership teams to get in their head is that they're going to make mistakes and they're going to have struggles, and plan on it. So how and when and where is this maybe likely to happen? When teams initially form, they have a very high level of confidence. Everybody's gung-ho about the plan. Everybody wants to be a part of it, and yet they haven't started doing anything. And so as this team starts to get together doing stuff, often they hit a very low spot in stage two. This is the storming stage. They hit a stage where people say, you know what, I didn't sign up for a fight. I didn't sign up for conflict. I didn't sign up for problems. I signed up for fun and a good ministry exercise. Stage number two is generally where people jump off the ship.
What do the numbers represent? Is that years or decades?
I don't know how to answer that question. It probably depends on the team. But I think it's a process that teams go through. So we have forming, which is stage number one, storming, number two, norming, number three, and performing, number four. So what's the forming stage? The role of the leader in the forming stage is to cast a vision. Say, this is something I'd like to do, or, you know, will you join? Will you join me in what this idea is? Offer opportunities for people, and also to accept input from the team. So the role of the team in the forming stage is to respond to that call for involvement. And then also to analyze the vision. Like, is this a good idea? Should this be done? And if it should be done, then hey, let's get on board with this. Is this a realistic opportunity, or is it just some crazy idea that somebody had? And that's really some of the very initial stages of formation of a ministry or a team. Some of the behaviors that are going on in the forming stage is that people are making contact, people are getting to know each other, people are developing some level of trust and communications. One thing that's critical in the forming stage, the first stage, is that all the members are dependent on the leader. Like, everybody probably got a phone call from the chairman or from the chief visionary, who said, "Do you want to be a part of this?" And they got invited in. So then everybody kind of goes back to that chief visionary and says, "Like, is this what you want me to do?" Or they're really dependent on the leader. And the main characteristics of the forming stage. One thing that's very true about the forming stage is people aren't very clear about their roles, and the mission or the vision isn't really owned by the whole group. People are kind of standing on the outside saying, "I think I'd like to be a part of this. I want to be a part of it enough to hear what's going on, but you know what, I'm not sure I want to give my life to this. I'm not sure I'm really all there." And we're kind of wondering, what's really going to be happening? So really, there isn't a lot of trust and confidence. There's maybe not a lot of conflict, but there isn't a lot of trust and confidence. People don't have much history with each other. Like, there's a lot of people that are really good friends until they work together. That's one thing we experience. People are kind of checking each other out and trying to decide if they could work with each other. and people are not really committed to the team. But they're interested, but they're not all there. The relationships in the forming stage, there's not been much testing of trust. Relationships are distant. If there's criticism, it kind of happens behind the scenes. People kind of talk to each other after the meeting and say, well, you know, what he's talking about here is a good idea, but, you know, he should be thinking about this. And so there's kind of this covert, undercover stuff going on. Often the effort is very much on an individual basis. One individual says he's going to do this to make it happen. Another individual says he's going to do this. And it's not really jointed together. The focus is on the mission and the vision. People are deciding if this is a good mission, a good vision. Should I be a part of it or not? You know, the value of the forming stage is that every great dream has to start somewhere. The forming stage isn't bad. It's just a stage. Without a start, there can't be an ending. One thing the forming stage does, it exposes who on the team are the directive initiators. It exposes who are those people that are willing to get up and talk and say, you know what, an organization ought to be formed in Turkmenistan, okay? And there should be Christian churches in Turkmenistan among Russian Muslims. And like, can you imagine communist Muslims? Like, they exist, did you know that? Like, but they should be Christians and we should be working there. Somebody needs to get up and say that. And the forming stage shows us who those people are that have those kinds of visions. It exposes the people that are a little psycho and crazy. They do crazy stuff. They get attention doing crazy stuff because that's how they get other people to do crazy stuff with them. And it shows us who these people are. But that's not everybody, right? And you need some other kinds of people on the team to balance things out. Okay, moving from the forming stage to the storming stage, I think you probably assume what the storming stage is all about. In order to move from the forming stage to the storming stage, you have to agree on a mission. And there needs to be some day when you say, all right, this is our mission statement, and this is why we exist. And until you set goals and establish roles, okay, so who is going to be the field administrator, and who is going to be the team leader, and who's going to be the secretary, and who's going to be the program developer? In order to do that, like, that's where people's toes start getting stepped on. It's where people start saying, well, but I wanted that job, and I'm better at that, or he's better at that, and he should do it. You know, that's where people's commitment starts to get challenged. And that's what initiates the storming stage. In the storming stage, you have to decide to actually be on the team, because if you remember that slide, like, things are going downhill. And you have to actually decide if you're going to hang on through the valley to come out the other side. If you don't decide to stay on the team, now would be a good time to get on a different team. You have to define a reward structure. In other words, when are we going to know we're going to have been successful? Often the steps from the forming to the storming stage feels like things are falling apart, but guess what? There's hope. They're actually probably on the way to coming together when you're moving from forming to storming. All right, the storming stage, life happens. Roles and responsibilities are articulated, agendas are displayed, and the bad thing is that problem solving doesn't work that well. Like, you come back to a meeting and the same agenda item is still a problem and we can't get past it because George always thinks this and John always thinks this and Sam always just wishes these two guys would get their heads together and not disagree. In the storming stage, we're often trying new ideas, often splinter groups form, and sadly, in the storming stage, people start setting boundaries, and they start saying, you know what, I can't work with this guy, and I can't work with this guy, but the two of us, we can come over here and we can work together, so let's have our little holy huddle over here, and we'll withdraw from the main activity and we'll start our own little thing. Some of the feelings that are going on during the storming stage is that there's a lot of anxiety. People are worried, and people are worried for themselves. People are worried that they're going to get hurt, and sadly, people do get hurt in a storming stage. People push for power and position. Yes, we're all Christians, and yes, we might all be Mennonites, but guess what? There's plenty of politics among us, aren't there? Hope that wasn't a surprise. Competition is high. Cliques form, little team spirit. We're not in it for the other person. We're in it for ourselves. We're looking how we can get our agenda accomplished and wiggle through this group of people. that feels a bit like a spaghetti pile right now. Sometimes you see a lot of personal attacks in this phase, and if you have some really highly directive people in the group, they can get brutal in the storming stage. They can really do a lot of personal attacks. And the truth is, it's not just anyone's fault that you're in the storming stage. It's the stage of the team, and it's the stage of the vision, and it's how life happens. In this stage is the lowest is a stage when you have the highest participation by some members and you have the lowest participation by some members all at the same time. You got some people that never talk and you got some people that always talk. You got some people that never show up, you got some people that always show up. It's not really a joint effort, it's a disjointed effort. You have a lot of communication problems. So today's topic is communication breakdowns. What did he say? Something about communism breaking down. Oh, that's old news. Wake me up when it's over. Hey, hear that? The meeting's over. All right? I like that. That really shows about how some teams function. In this storming stage, we lose a lot of trust. Conversations get very political and people get really guarded. While some people are getting guarded, there's other people that are looking for ace cards to play. And there's people that are saying, I'm going to stay quiet until just the right time. I'm going to say what I need to say to make sure that young guy gets his feathers trimmed. And that's how guarded people operate. They say what they want to say to manipulate outcomes. Communication is less about function and more about position. And that's really sad. It's less about the vision and more about what can I get out of it. And like we can look at the disciples, and they did plenty of this kind of stuff. And well, today we're disciples, and we're doing plenty of this kind of stuff too. So one thing that's sad is that in the storming stage, some people stop talking and start shouting, and some people start avoiding the people that are shouting, and we have what looks like complete chaos. It looks a bit like a train wreck. During the storming stage, the nice people leave the team. The tough people roll up their sleeves and try harder. The sly people run a coup or a secret campaign. And I really believe that godliness disappears from all relationships on the team. And there's nobody that's doing it right in the storming stage. We all need to get on our knees and repent when we're in the storming stage, because we're all sinning in one way or another. Honestly, leaders during a storming stage of a theme feel like the biggest mistake. They like, why did we ever do this, and who said this is a good idea? Every leader, you know, makes mistakes in this stage, and I think that there's just nobody that's getting it right. So it's probably best to just acknowledge that so that you can start moving on. The role of the leader in the storming stage is to serve the team by creating a safe environment for people to talk. Obviously, it isn't a safe environment. So what? Leaders have to do what? They have to go first, and they have to start saying, All right, we have a problem. Now, how are we going to fix at least one little problem? Make a safe environment. Accept criticism, and there'll be people that are looking around, and all fingers point to the leader. Like, the reason we're in this big fight is because the leader is the way he is. Maybe. Leaders need thick skin in this stage. One thing that I don't think can be overemphasized is that leaders need to pray for the team, need to pray for teamwork. And then God can do things that nobody else can do, because God actually changes hearts. I don't change your heart, and you don't change mine. It's God that changes hearts. So what's the role of the team? The team needs to start at some point, get so sick of not working together that they decide that it's much less painful to start working together than to not work together. And so that's when there's starting to be some hope, is when you see people on the team start saying, oh, okay, you know what? We had this conflict last week. Let's not have it again this week. Accept care from each other. That's a hard one, because there's people that don't want to be cared for. Focus on the relationships. Relationships are the key getting out of the storming stage. Start expressing differences of ideas, feelings, and opinions. One thing about the behaviors are all reacting to leadership. Everybody's saying it's the leader's fault. Members are independent or counter-dependent. If you do this, I'm going to do that. All right, the task of the storming stage is to identify the power and control issues. That's what it does for the team. You start seeing who actually is in charge, and you're seeing who would like to be in charge, and you deal with the power struggles. The value of the storming stage is it exposes our own selfish motives, and it causes us plenty of room to repent. It teaches us how to communicate with words, sentences, and paragraphs. Before that, we just kind of have thoughts and malformed ideas in our heads that we don't communicate. It also teaches us how to negotiate. It's hard to see the value of the storming stage, but folks, the storming stage does awesome things for teams. And if you can get through the storming stage, you can look back and say, at some point, say, this did good things for us. It wasn't fun. We don't want to necessarily go back there, but it did good things for us. It exposes the relationally sensitive people. It exposes the calculating people. It teaches us that problems came to pass. They don't come to stay. One thing the storming stage does is it teaches us, especially as leaders, to rely on our critics. Our critics are our biggest resource. They see what we don't see. And without them, we are doomed. If you've been through the storming stage, you know what I'm talking about. One thing about the storming stage is it's the I told you so people's greatest moment. Instead of the directive initiator's greatest moments, it's the people that were quiet during the forming stage are now saying, see, I said something about these problems. You should have, it's the you should have said something people's greatest moment too. And it's like, yeah, we should have talked about that. And then it's the you wouldn't listen to me people's greatest moment too. All right, steps from the storming to the norming stage. Leaders should actively support and reinforce team behavior. We need to create a positive environment. We need to recognize team wins. Often those are small at first. And we need to buy into objectives. Moving from the storming to the norming stage, we start seeing people starting to listen to each other and taking time for each other. And after the meeting, they're talking to each other, not because they have a secret agenda, but they're talking to each other because they're trying to actually get to know each other. And they're saying, you know what, did we have a little misunderstanding that we should clear up before we move on? It's so different from a, hey, we should get together and talk about how we can get rid of this guy kind of meeting. So it's building trust by honoring commitments, and it's developing a we can succeed kind of vision. In the norming stage, the role of the leader is to facilitate processes. If we look at the leader, his role, again, go first, but it's about process now. We're not talking about getting people together. We're not talking about solving problems. We're talking about processes. So how do we do accounting so that payday is always on the 20th? Well, it's a process. You actually have to have money in the bank on the 10th, and you have to have the checks made out on the 15th and in the mailbox on the 18th. Processes. And the norming stage, the emphasis is on processes. You know something about that, Dennis? The team isn't just trusting the leader now. The team is trusting the process. It's saying, oh, okay, we now get it. We know how this works. And the feedback, again, goes back to the process. The focus is the process. All right, members agree about roles and processes for problem solving. One of the main behaviors of the norming stage is that decisions are made through negotiation and consensus building. They're not made through arguments, they're made through how can we talk about, how can we give and take, and how can we get together. I like this little cartoon. It says, you know, we are communicating better, but we're still not out of the woods. That's the norming stage right there. Like, you remember the trauma of the storming stage, but you know things are going better now, and you celebrate that, and you keep it up. Some of the characteristics of the norming stage is that you have success, and it's team confidence is going up. All right, norming to the performing stage, one of the big things is to maintain traditions. One thing we do in our management team and Dryden is I started seeing that people are sitting at the same spot around the table when we get together for a management team. Very small thing. And it was going on so regularly that one time somebody sat in a different place. We're like, whoa, this upset the fruit basket. Okay. I need to wrap things up here. We're just about done with the main part. So I'd like to just talk real briefly about the performing stage. The performing stage, the behaviors of the performing stage, we start seeing that members are interdependent. They need each other, they work with each other, and they can negotiate with each other without necessarily the team leader's direct input. They can fluidly deal with problems, and the best guy for that problem will take it, and the teams can, that's a functioning team. And it's beautiful when you start seeing it happen. So I'd like to stop with that. There's more in the your handouts, and I'd like to say thanks for coming out. Bless you as you go through the stages of team development. It's worth it.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.